help us help you. Get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, important show today. Something's going on in the U.S. economy that people should know about because it hasn't ended, and more likely than not, it will get worse. All right, what am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about what's going on in the money markets. And I'm talking about the Federal Reserve. You know, the Fed this past week had its second decision to lower interest rates. That's called the federal funds rate or the benchmark rate or the policy rate, whatever you want to name it. And they reduced it 0.25% to the 1.75% to 2% range. First of all, it's going to have no effect whatsoever on the real economy. But I'm not talking about the real economy. I'm talking about the financial sector of the economy, which is beginning to show some very serious fragmenting or problems. Okay, what are those problems? Well, you know, we've got bubbles going in several financial markets. We got junk bonds, particularly the energy bonds side of the junk bonds. About half of junk bonds, I think, are energy company related. Junk bonds are companies that are pretty shaky financially, and they need more money, and they borrow more money. But because they're shaky, they only can borrow at high interest rates. So they borrow at high interest rates. And when the economy shifts, or that particular sector, energy sector, turns down, they don't have the revenues to pay the interest and the principal on the high interest on their bonds that they borrowed, and they default. And default is contagious. It first spreads to other energy borrowers, and then it spreads to the junk bond market in general. Then it can spread elsewhere, other credit markets. Okay, so that's a warning sign area, junk bonds, leveraged loans, as they're called. Think of them as junk loans, where there's actual borrowing, not an issuing of bonds, but a borrowing from banks that are at high interest rates by companies that can't really afford to. All right, that's a problem area. Another area of concern, growing concern, is the return to derivatives called collateralized debt obligations back to where they were in 2007, securitized debt, which is very contagious when it happens. Another area is called triple B investment grade corporate bonds. In other words, they're supposed to be just a little safer than junk bonds. Ah, but they're really not. For various reasons I'm not going to get into, they categorize them as triple B, very low quality investment grade, the best kind of bonds you can buy, investment grade bonds. Well, half of investment grade bonds are now triple B, really junk. So you have this massive overhang of bad debt out there. And as I said before, bad debt is okay as long as your revenues are rising, your prices are rising, your sales are rising, so you generate cash flow in order to continue to finance that interest and that principal. But once the economy slows down or turns down, you don't have the cash, well, then you either just pay interest if the bank or whoever loaned you the money allows you to do that, or they roll it over and refinance it again, give you a little short-term reprieve. Or they call in the debt and you go default. And default has a big psychological effect across the board. Okay, so, you know, those are areas. I've talked about those before. Keep your eye on them. But now there's a new one. It's called the repo market. Repo is short for repurchase agreements. All right, we're going to spend some time talking about the repo market. We're going to get some background first. All right. Just to finish up, financial instability candidate markets here. You know, I talked about junk BB, triple B, leverage loans, CDOs. We'll talk about repos. But globally, there's big problems in financial markets. India, shadow banks, and imminent defaults. And the Indian government is trying desperately to get a handle on these defaults and this fragility in the shadow banks. Shadow banks are that financial institutions that are not regulated commercial banks. I'm talking about hedge funds, equity firms, money market funds, and so forth, mutual funds, etc. Insurance companies, pension funds, right? Okay. Big trouble with shadow banks in India. And they're desperately trying to bring that under control. I don't think they will. UE banks, Europe banks. We know the problems with Deutsche Bank. Well, Commerce Bank, the other German bank, just laid off big thousands here, consolidating branches. And, you know, so there's a growing, continuing problem with Commerce Bank. Italian banks, all of them, pretty much. And UBS. The UBS bank, the Swiss bank, watch it. Then we got China, right? We have problems in debt and fragility there in what's called wealth management products sold by shadow banks there. China's been trying to get a hold on its shadow banks for years now. Every time they do, the economy slows down and they got to back off and pump more money into the economy, and that resurrects the shadow banks over there again. It's a whack-a-mole thing going on since 2015. And then you have the local government financing vehicles, as they're called. These are local governments that have extended into property, commercial and residential financing and booming, right? And state-owned enterprises, some of them, you know, like coal-producing and so forth, that are just can't produce in the global economy anymore. They've been propped up by the government. So, you know, there's problems over there financially. China has great resources, can absorb it, unlike countries like Argentina, where you have a big financial crisis going on, having borrowed $57 billion from the IMF. To pay what? To pay foreign speculators and investors. You see, countries like Argentina have, particularly in Latin America, have invested in dollarized debt. In other words, they've borrowed from hedge funds and others outside the country in dollars. So when the value of the dollar goes up, which it is, we've talked to reasons for that, then the amount of debt they got to pay goes up. Because their currency goes down, they got to accumulate more of their own currency, Argentine pesos, to pay a higher debt in dollars. So dollarized debt has been a big problem. At the same time, the global economy is slowing down, so earning dollars from exporting Argentine products has slowed down. Oh, okay, so they got to pay more in dollars to finance their principal and interest on their debt they borrowed from vulture funds, but they have less dollars to pay for it. Oh, well, that's the root of the crisis. When it becomes clear that Argentina doesn't have the money to pay, guess what? People dump, investors dump the peso, and that makes it worse, because now they have even fewer pesos to exchange for dollars to pay the higher dollar debt. Anyway, I've talked about the financing crisis over there in Argentina, but it's not going away, getting worse. You know, inflation in Argentina is 57%. Unemployment is double digit and rising rapidly. Peso's down 30%. Yeah. Oh, but the stock market in Argentina is up 100% this year. Well, does that tell you something about that kind of a Macri government, what it's really all about? You know, when he's first thing he came in office, he paid off the hedge funds, the U.S. hedge funds, you know, Paul Singer's Elliott Management and all those other guys who demanded even more payoff than the IMF was willing to negotiate back a decade ago, held firm till the U.S. played a role, overturned the government there. And first thing this Macri government, this Macri guy did was pay off the hedge funds. And then he went to New York and got even more dollarized investments. Yeah, they loaded up on debt again. And now they can't pay it again. And that's why you get the IMF pumping in $57 billion so that Argentine government can pay off the hedge funds. You know, that $57 billion loan, $44 billion has been already, you know, distributed. Doesn't go to Argentina. It goes right to New York hedge funds and banks. Yeah. And then, of course, now you got austerity. You got to pay for this, Argentina. At the same time, what's happening? Its currency is collapsing, which means the price of its imports are also going up, and capital is fleeing the country, and they've got to raise the domestic central bank rates to try to stem the outflow of capital. And of course, higher interest rates causes the economy to crash. So you get massive inflation and rising unemployment and recession at the same time. Well, that's the mess that Argentina's in, and it goes right back to Washington. Okay. So those are some of the financial hotspots that should be watched closely. All right, but I want to get to the one that's now appearing on the horizon, and that's the repo market, or repurchase agreement market. Got to take a look at that. All right, but first a few words on the U.S. Fed decision, Chairman Powell's decision to lower rates. What is that represent? Well, you know, if you listen to his press conference that he held right after, what you get is the following picture. By the way, the Federal Reserve makes these decisions based on a committee of federal district presidents, 17 members at the moment, and 7 governors of the Fed. Makes this decision. So it's not a just Powell's decision, but the committee called the Federal Open Market Committee is split. In this last decision, some said, well, we should lower rates. Others said, no, you know, the economy is not really in recession yet. Come on, I mean, aren't we supposed to lower rates when it's in recession? Why are we now lowering rates as a kind of insurance before it's even in recession? And then we won't have enough ammunition when it really is in recession to try to stimulate recovery, you know? And that's the trend, that's the drift. The Fed and central banks have gotten to a point where they're just pumping all this money into the system all the time. And now they don't have much rate, interest rate leverage when a crisis does hit. Well, why are they pumping all this money in for so long, constantly so much for so long? And it's not just the U.S., the Fed, you know, it's the European Central Bank, it's Bank of Japan, Bank of England, etc. Right? Why are they doing this? Right? Because this central banks and the monetary policy of capitalism no longer is about using tools to stabilize the economy. You know, lower rates when you're in a recession to help recovery. When you have too much inflation, raise rates to cool it off, right? That's the textbook stuff that they're still misteaching students. Now it's about subsidizing capital incomes. That's what it is. You subsidize capital incomes by subsidizing corporations, and then corporations distribute their subsidized excess profits to their shareholders. You see, the corporations are the conduit of capitalism to the capitalists and the shareholders themselves. So if you keep rates chronically low, interest rates chronically low over a period of time, and of course, after 2008-09, they were 0.15 of 1% for 6 years. You know, one quarter or less for 6 years, interest rates. The Fed fund rate, you know, that all other rates follow. Yeah, well, first of all, what that does is it makes borrowing costs low for companies that export, right? U.S. international companies that export goods from the U.S., they can borrow cheaply, subsidize costs. It also tends to keep the dollar low, so multinational corporations that are doing business offshore can convert their offshore profits in local currencies back to dollars very profitably. You know, if the dollar rises, like in Argentina, dollar rises, peso falls, to convert your pesos into dollars, you're going to lose a big chunk of profits. So keeping the dollar low subsidizes U.S. multinational corporations' offshore operations. Right? The low dollar, well, the low rates, rather, keeping rates low, you know, correlated with low dollar. If you keep rates low as well, businesses, U.S. businesses, can then issue bonds very cheaply, raise money in bond markets very cheaply. You know, and that's what they've been doing and they're continuing to. Look, Microsoft, $52 billion in profits last year. Stock buybacks from raising bonds. And same with, you know, tech companies are big violators of this. They issue bonds even though they're sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars, like Apple, $250 billion, and still issue corporate bonds to raise cash. Why? Because it's so cheap to do so, it just turns around and gives that cash to its shareholders while it continues to sit on its $250 billion, 95% of which, of course, is kept in offshore subsidiaries, so it doesn't have to pay taxes. Okay, so low interest rates allow companies to issue corporate bonds very cheaply. And all these means pump up corporate profits. Of course, keeping wages low and not covering benefits, shifting benefit costs to workers, that all, you know, keeps the profits. But that's profits from cost reduction. I'm talking about profits from finance, manipulating money. Okay, so all those forces cause corporate profits to go through the roof. And then corporations turn around, the conduit for their capitalist shareholders, turn around and distribute it to their shareholders. And ever since 2011, it's been $1 trillion a year in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. I keep saying that every show, but, you know, people got to understand that's the big driver of income inequality. Yes, wages are being kept down, minimum wages aren't adjusted, union differentials are disappearing, et cetera, et cetera. People are working more second, third, part-time temp jobs. Don't get wage increases. Yeah, that generates corporate profits, but the big profits are generated from what I just described. And then they turn around and they distribute it. $1 trillion a year since 2011. Last year, $1.2 trillion. This year, even more in terms of trillions. And that's why the stock market keeps hanging up there, even though it should have corrected long ago, and every time it corrects, it comes right back, because there's this wall of money that corporations are sitting on, and they're distributing a big chunk of it. They're investing in financial markets themselves, because it's much more profitable, you see, because they're boosting those financial markets with their buybacks, so they invest there as well. Or they invest in mergers and acquisitions to make their balance sheets look better than they are, get rid of competitors. Okay. So, here we go with Powell's press conference. Powell says, oh, look, the economy is looking good on the one hand, but the global economy is looking bad. Well, what does he mean? The U.S. economy is looking good. Well, he says household consumer spending and consumer confidence is still up there, and we're still seeing job creation. Those are the two things he's hanging his hat on for why the economy is good and we shouldn't cut rates too much. You know, that's one faction in the Fed, Open Market Committee, that says, oh, well, look, you know, why are we going to cut, you know, a half a percent point when we only have 2% to deal with in interest? Well, you know, let's go a little slower. It's not really here yet. You know, more rational approach. Whereas others on the committee say, no, we got to cut real big. We got to anticipate the recession that's coming and preempt it if we can. Yeah, but what if it doesn't come? Mm-hmm. Then you're giving a lot of free money to the bankers and big businesses. Okay, so, you know, the economy is good on the one hand because of consumer spending and income and confidence. Well, there's signs that that's cracking. I'm not going to go into that. But there are signs that keep appearing that consumer spending is not doing as great as people think it is or about to reverse. You know, one thing is the trade war. Chase Bank itself has said that, you know, what we're doing is running into a problem here. The trade war is going to take $1,000 out of the average household in the U.S. $1,000. Okay. So, consumer spending is not all that great. The same with jobs, you know. Look, we had a couple months here in the last 4 or 5 months when job creation kind of fell through the floor. The average job creation is 120,000 a month for the last 3 months. Well, for the same period last year, it was over twice that. So there are signs that this lagging indicator, jobs, is beginning to weaken as well. Okay. So, you know, I'm not as optimistic as the Chairman Powell is about spending and jobs. And jobs, of course, are the big determinant of household spending. I'm not as confident of that. Okay, so what's on the negative side? Well, U.S. trade policy and the trade war and global growth clearly slowing. And Powell admitted that himself, right? Global growth is slowing down. In fact, the OECD today came out, joined the World Bank and IMF saying the global economy is slowing down. And then there's geopolitical risks like Brexit. Uncertainty about real investment and business investment, you know, in plant and equipment, which is stalled here in the U.S., along with manufacturing, global recession, U.S. recession in manufacturing now. Okay. So we have these problems globally. So, where are we? Well, we got a picture of global pressures slowing down the global economy and beginning to hit the U.S. economy. But the Fed is kind of discounting that and said, we're going to err on the side of positive U.S. economy, even though the global economy is getting worse and it's beginning to look like it might spill over to the U.S. For now, we're only going to cut 0.25%, right? And the Fed committee is divided on this. But what also came up, you know, well, let's back up a minute before we get to repos. The global economy weakening and increasingly unstable. Right? Well, the World Bank, the OECD, which is the European Statistics Organization, all say global GDP is slowing significantly. Global manufacturing recession. World trade is now growing, barely growing, if at all, and less than world GDP, which is the first time that's ever happened. We have the two of four capitalist centers in the world that drive the whole capitalist economy pretty much flat. And the momentum into decline. That's Europe and Japan. You know, that's over $20 trillion in global GDP. We have China slowing, and it's becoming clear that their fiscal stimulus mini packages are having less and less of an effect. The same for its monetary stimulus. We have Germany, manufacturing, industrial production pretty much in recession, big indicator. We have India, where we have problems with the shadow banks. Well, as I talked about, problems with shadow banks, non-performing bank loans, trillions, over $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans in India, Europe, and Japan. We got the Argentina, right? We got economies slowing in Indonesia, South Africa, and even Australia, Turkey. Oil prices going up. In the U.S., as I said, we have manufacturing, construction, although a little reversal there going on last month. And business investment, business confidence down, U.S.-China trade war, all of that, right? And what we got globally going on is competitive devaluations by central bank monetary policy. What do I mean by that? Well, as the U.S. tries to lower its interest rate, that interest rate is still well above the interest rates elsewhere around the world, particularly in Europe, in Japan. We have this gap, right? And that gap really causes investors to shift their money to the higher rates in the U.S. when the global economy is slowing. And there were safe havens, and the best safe haven is the U.S. And if you're going to invest in treasuries, you're going to have to convert your currencies to dollars. That drives up the value of the dollar. So lowering U.S. interest rates that would otherwise lower the value of the dollar is more than offset by the wall of money coming in, driving up the dollar. There's $17 trillion in negative rates, interest rates, rising rapidly around the world, mostly in Europe and Japan, these two weak sectors of the global capitalist economy. And as the U.S. tries to lower rates, well, they're lowering them even faster, or to keep the gap. Why? Because it lowers the value of their currency and therefore helps them generate exports, sales, competitively against the U.S. and others, which they have to do to keep their domestic economies from falling into recession. You know, Europe and Japan and other places are more dependent on exports than the U.S., so they can't afford to allow that gap between U.S. interest rates and the dollar and their own interest rates and their own currency to close in a slowing global economy. See, that's the key. So whenever the U.S. lowers rates, they lower even further into negative territory, which causes great financial distortions and instabilities. Well, what this amounts to, lowering your currency by lowering your interest rates, is competitive devaluations by central bank rate manipulation. You know, in the 1930s, we had a similar problem. We had a collapse of world trade for political reasons and depression reasons. And we had countries declaring their currency devalued. But the problem with devaluation, like the problem with tariffs, is everyone can do it. And it just sets off a chain reaction. And pretty soon everyone's doing it. And you got to spiral down to a crisis. Well, 1930s was devaluations by government fiat. Well, now we have devaluations de facto by interest rate manipulation by governments. It's the same thing. It's a sign of crisis, competitive valuations. And, of course, Trump's trade war is an attempt to impose tariffs to offset this devaluation competitive moves by other countries. Okay. Emerging markets, flight to safety everywhere. Again, as federal interest rates are greater than interest rates the rest of the world, causes currency collapse. You know, we got a currency war going on de facto behind monetary central bank policies as well. And Trump wants to push down rates because in the short run, it offsets his tariffs. Declining currencies elsewhere negate his tariffs. And, you know, he's relying totally on tariff wars. That's one of the reasons why tariffs aren't a good tool. He wants to, he brags on one hand about the wall of money coming in as a good thing. Well, it's coming in, though, because of slowing down of the global economy, which is due to his trade wars in large part. Okay, so Trump wants the Fed to lower money. Okay. But by lowering the rates, you know, pushing down the dollar, he just causes other countries to do even more. And that pushes them into negative rates, which is really even more destabilizing, and causes money to flow back to the U.S., which drives up the dollar, you know. So it's not working. He's not looking at all the ramifications and all the connections, you know. He's just looking at, oh, let's drive down the dollar so it doesn't offset my tariffs. So the U.S. is really driving the competitive currency war globally and causing the global economy to slow down through its monetary policy and trade policies, right, causing crises and capital flight coming back to the U.S., all right. And competitive devaluations. Now, what about the effect of the Fed rate cut here on the U.S. economy? Look, a quarter of 1% isn't going to stimulate any real investment, you know, in plant and equipment, structures, so forth. Quarter percent, that's just lowering the cost of money if you're borrowing. But when the economy is not strong, businesses don't even want to borrow. You can give it to them for free and they won't borrow it. And the cost of money or cost of operations in business really doesn't drive real investment. What drives real investment is the expectations of profits, which has a lot to do with the global economy and business confidence and trade wars and all the other rest, you see. It's not the cost of money that drives investment, especially late in the business cycle. It's a host of other factors, mostly psychological. So, you know, it's not going to have much effect on the real economy. And that's maybe one reason why some of the members on the Fed committee say, hey, you know, we're being pushed politically here, but, you know, let's go as slow as we can because this is, we're just wasting our ammunition. Right. Okay. Now, how does the Fed and central banks lower rates? Well, this is important because it's a preview of where we're going here with the repo market. Well, by pumping money into the banking system itself, right? The banks have to keep what's called reserves on hand. And estimates are there's about $1 trillion that it has to keep the banking system of reserves on hand. Well, if it's on hand, they can't lend it out. You know, they can only lend out the excess over the required reserves. That's called excess reserves. And if they don't have a lot of excess reserves, well, then banks will charge a higher interest rate to lend it out, right? If there's a shortage of something, you know, you raise the price of it. If there's a shortage of money, you raise the price of the money, which is the interest rate. So if they don't have a lot of excess reserves, rates are going to rise. So the Fed, central banks, pump money into the private banks so they have sufficient extra excess reserves that they can lend. If they got a big supply of it, you know, then what are they going to do if they got a big supply of it? Well, if they got a big supply of it, they're going to lower their rates. Okay? And that's exactly what the Fed wants to do when it pumps in a lot of money, to create an excess supply of money in the private banks so the rates go low. And if the rates are low, then other non-bank businesses tend to borrow. Okay? Well, how does the Federal Reserve put money into the private banks? Well, traditional method is called open market operations, where it buys and sells bonds that the banks got to hold, you know, in their reserves. They can't loan out the bonds, you know, but if the bank, the Federal Reserve, exchanges real money for those bonds held by the private banks, well, then the private banks have what they can loan out, real money, not Fed bonds, treasuries. All right, so what's called open market operations is where the Fed, right, buys the bonds back from the private banks, buys the treasuries back from the private banks. That puts cash, more cash, in the hands of the private banks. And then the private banks have more to lend out. If they got more to lend out, they lower their rates. That's more enticing to borrowers. And then the money gets out into the real economy, and that's what creates the money supply, when it gets out into the real economy. Okay. Another way the Fed can do it, and does do it, is when it really wants to flood the economy directly, and it engages in what's called quantitative easing, or QE. That's where the Fed prints the money and buys up bonds held by private investors as well as banks, particularly subprime bonds. Subprime. That's been going on from 2009 to 2016. The Fed injected massive amounts of money directly into the economy, into the banks, through QE. In other words, what was a window with open market operations became a garage door flooding with QE. And there were other means too, called special auctions, where the Fed just called the different sectors of the financial community together, you know, like finance companies and mutual funds, whatever, and said, hey, look, we know you need money. Here, tell us how much you want to pay us for us to borrow it, and, you know, we'll agree on whatever you want to buy it for. Of course, they buy it for very, very little, and that put a lot of extra money into the economy as well. So in a crisis, it was open market operations, QE, and special auctions. And all of those pumped money into the economy, massive amounts of money. And, of course, that pumping money in raise the debt, the balance sheet debt held by the Federal Reserve. And it was, you know, $4.5 trillion at its peak, more than that, because when things matured, bonds, some bonds matured, they just reloaned it out. So over $5 trillion through QE, the U.S. Fed pumped into the economy. Now, what all that massive increase of money did was really fatten up the excess reserves that banks had to lend. You know, the excess reserves are like $3 trillion, $2.93 trillion at the peak there, about 2014. And banks got used to that. Yeah, they got used to all that. All right, so now we get to the repo crisis. What is the repo crisis? Well, the repurchase market, repurchase agreement market, is a market where banks lend to each other overnight using treasuries that they have as collateral. In other words, bank one says to bank two, look, I need to borrow $200 million because my customers want loans from me. I'm going to give you the treasuries I have. You give me real money so I can loan it to my customers. So treasuries are used as collateral in bank-to-bank lending. And an interest rate at which the borrowing occurs bank-to-bank is called the repo rate. It's very much like the federal funds rate. You know, federal funds rate is overnight rate, but that's the regular market rate bank to bank. But there's the special side channel called the repo market. It's become very important, side channel. Okay, so early this week, what happened was the interest rates in the repo market spiked from 2% normal to 10% overnight. 10%. Well, you know, rates go up when there's a shortage of funds to lend. Again, banks, you know, when they don't have a lot, they charge you more. There was a shortage of cash in the repo market. Caused that spike. Caught the Fed totally off balance. Why is this happening? And that's scary enough because the Fed apparently doesn't know what's going on in its own financial plumbing. So why was there such a shortage of cash? Well, the official explanation coming out is that, oh, you know, the banks at the end of the quarter here, end of September, have to make tax payments. So they needed more cash to pay taxes to the Treasury. And that caused the shortage of cash that spiked up. Look, you know, it's no different than the shortage of cash at the end of June or the end of March. You know, why did this time did it spike? Just to make tax payments? No. There's a shortage of cash for other more fundamental reasons, I believe. Shortage of cash in the banks. Right? What are those reasons? You know, by the way, shortage means that, you know, there used to be $3 trillion in private bank reserves, you know, several years ago. Now there's only $1.3 trillion. And $1 trillion of that has to be kept in required reserves. They can't, it's the buffer they got to hold on to, you know, and it's mostly in the form of treasuries. They can't lend it out. So that gives them only $300 billion in lendable reserves. They used to have $3 trillion. Now they have $300 billion. Oh, there's the shortage. Well, why is that a shortage now? Well, it can't be because of the tax payments. That's a short-term, temporary thing. We see a long-term shortage of cash and excess reserves in the banking system. Okay. Well, I think there are more fundamental explanations for this. For example, keep in mind, for the last 2 years, the U.S. has run a deficit, a budget deficit of well over $1 trillion. Yes, even last year, I think they officially was $900 billion. Yeah, it's over $1 trillion. And this year, it's officially over $1 trillion, a deficit. Well, the Fed has been selling bonds, treasuries, to raise money to give to the U.S. Treasury to cover the deficit. I'm talking about the government deficit, the budget deficit of $1 trillion a year. It's been doing this for 2 years, you see. Okay, once again, the Fed sells bonds, treasury bonds, on behalf of the treasury. Banks buy the bonds, give the Fed cash for the bonds. In other words, more bonds that can't be loaned out go into the private banking system, and cash that could be loaned out comes out of the private banking system, and then it covers the budget deficit. What I'm saying is this reduction in reserves going on in the banks from $3 trillion to $300 billion could be largely driven by the fact that the Fed and the Treasury have to finance these massive trillion-dollar deficits that the U.S. has. Now, the U.S. could go and sell those bonds to foreigners, but, you know, foreigners, particularly the big ones, aren't buying as much anymore. Trade war, anybody? Slowing global economy? Yeah. All right. So that's one explanation, I believe, a more fundamental, systemic, long-term problem of financing the U.S. budget deficit, which are driven largely by the big tax cuts for the rich corporations and rising defense spending. That's like three-fourths of the deficit, annual deficit. All right, on top of this, there's another related reason why cash is coming out of the private banking system. And that has to do with the Fed, the last 2 years as well, selling off its debts, its massive balance sheet of $4.5 trillion that it built up to bail out the banks and subsidize them for so long when they didn't need it from 2010 to 2016. $4.5 trillion. Well, the Fed, last 2 years, has been trying to sell that off. And it sold off maybe about $1 trillion, I think, roughly. Well, when you say sold off, what that means is the Fed is taking the bonds that it bought during the crisis and selling them to the banking system and investors, and the banking system and broker-dealers, right, are giving money to the Fed for that sell-off. Money's coming out. Financing the deficit, selling off the balance sheet, two big factors that are sucking money out of the private banking system, excess reserves, so that there's only $300 billion. Well, that's a cash shortage. If you have a cash shortage, you're going to charge more for people who want to borrow from you, hence the repo rate goes up. Okay, those are long-term developments. How do you explain the short-term spike? Well, we got short-term factors overlaid on these long-term, more fundamental factors that are causing the spike, I believe. But they're only talking about the short-term factors, you know, paying taxes and so forth. I also think that there was what might be happening here is that the banks have a bigger demand for treasuries because their customers are demanding to buy more treasuries from them, customers offshore, as a haven with the global economy slowing down or negative interest rates, whatever, in the world. So the buying and selling of these treasuries here, as this huge wall of money comes in, might be involved in this as well. Right. Short term, it's interesting, corroborating this view, when this repo rate spiked to 10% on Monday, it was the same day that the Fed sold $54 billion of treasuries and pulled $54 billion out. Well, that precipitated it, you see. There wasn't really enough there because of these long-term fundamental factors, I believe. And the tax payments at the same time of pulling $54 billion out. You know, the Fed's been selling $50 to $100 billion every time of treasuries over and over here. All through. Well, that's because it needs to raise all that money for deficits. Okay. The banks have become addicted to also financial market investing. I think they need more and more excess cash. because they are investing more and more, lending, in other words, more than ever before, to customers who are investing in financial markets. And that's the consequence of the changing financial structure in shadow banks and speculative investing and so forth. They've gotten used to it since the 2009 crisis to lend more to financial side investing. They've gotten used to it. All these factors are involved. You know, they need $2.9 trillion in excess reserves, you know, not to $300 billion, $1.3 billion. Trillion. Excuse me, I'm talking about trillion. $2.9 trillion. $1.3 trillion, right? So structurally, and because of the financialization of the economy, they need more reserves. There's more demand for financial investing at the time that the Fed is pulling money out because it's selling its balance sheet, at the time the Fed is pulling more money out in order to finance the deficit, you know, comes together in the juncture when tax payments are due, all of that, there's not enough money. Oh, that's why the Fed has pumped $75 billion so far this week into the repo market. $75 billion. It's going to have to put more. Banks are addicted to financial investing and they need more cash. And the Fed's pulling the cash out to finance the deficit and sell off its balance sheet. Well, forget the balance sheet sell-off. That's done. In fact, what's coming is QE again. It may be a QE light. QE that will come through the repo market, you see. The Fed will now use the repo market more and more to pump money into the economy, not just open market operations and this, you know, federal funds rate and, you know, this quarter decline and this and that. I think that's why Trump isn't all that upset with the mere quarter, because he knows that we have this other channel of money injections, which should bring down the dollar even more. But once again, you know, are these forces of nominal rate cuts and repo market liquidity injections enough to weaken the dollar more than those global forces that are driving up the dollar as money floods into the U.S. economy? Because the rest of the world economy is far, far worse off, and their rates are falling into negative, and their currencies are collapsing. You see, the U.S. is the global capitalist center, the imperial center, and it's got all these tools, these financial tools, that it, in effect, can shuffle off the negative effects of the economic cycles onto the rest of the world. The U.S. dollar is, you know, the main means by which it does this. But central banks, you know, Fed central bank policies drive other central bank policies, either in tandem or inversely. IMF and World Bank and institutions are, you know, U.S.-controlled institutions. When the U.S. doesn't think it gets enough out of an institution, you know, It gives it the deep six. Well, it's given the WTO, World Trade Organization, that right now because, you know, Trump's trade wars are violating all the WTO rules and regulations. Well, so what? You know, we don't want. What do we care? It's Trump attitude. Okay, back to repos. Repos, watch out for the repo market, because if we had this kind of a problem, and the fundamental long-term forces are going to continue. In other words, the Fed has to finance the federal deficit, right? Well, it can shift on the QE, you know. It can do just the opposite. Instead of pulling money out by selling off his balance sheet, you know, now they will grow that balance sheet even more. And in fact, that was implied in Powell's press conference when he talked about organic balance sheet. Organic, he called it, right? Which means, you know, we'll grow it. We'll grow it. We'll sell some off, but we'll buy more than we sell off, right? And QE's back. Oh, a lot of the QE injection will go into the financial market. You see, that's one of the big disruptors. The Fed has really screwed up the global financial system, Fed and central banks, by pumping in all that money for so long, QEs, right? Negative rates, and they can't get rid of them anymore. It causes a big disruption. The system becomes addicted to it, to the negative rates, becomes addicted to the QE. I wrote about that in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, published 2 years ago, 2017, August. And then in subsequent articles for the World Financial Review and the European Financial Review, you can read them, by the way, on my blog, either on my blog, jackrasmus.com, read the reviews of the book, or, you know, you can read select chapters and these European Financial Review articles that followed the book, predicted what's happening right now, right, on my website, which is Kyklos Productions, K-Y-K-L-S Productions.com. You can get to it from the blog, jackrasmus.com, from the blog roll on the right. Just click on, go to my website. Well, J.P. Morgan says, watch out, you know. Watch out for December 31st. The volatility is not going away, according to Chase, because of the structural changes that have occurred in the capitalist financial system that I keep warning about, you know, caused by central banks, excessive injections, subsidizing capital incomes, and the financialization of the global economy, more shadow banks, you know, more unregulated liquid financial markets. This happened in 2008, you know. The repo market went belly up. It's a little different now. It's not in response to the rest of the financial instability. It is a sort of a red flag, a deja vu, you know, warning of approaching financial instability, the repo market. Watch it. QE light is coming via the repo market, probably, right? And the Fed now is quietly discussing new tools, you see, for the next crisis, which I will venture to say will include bail-ins, where if a financial institution or company crashes and you got deposits in that financial institution, they're not going to give you your money back. They're going to give you the worthless stock. You're going to bail out. Yeah, you're going to bail out that bank. Oh, that shadow bank. Stay away from the shadow banks. You know, the big ones, you know, Chase and so forth, they won't let go under. But the smaller ones, they will. But you're going to bail them out. Watch out for mutual funds. Yeah. Okay. So that's what the repo market is all about. It's another financial market that's showing great fragility, because there's a lack of cash, and that's always an indication of a pending crisis when there's insufficient cash in the market to cover the debts, to cover the operations. That's when you have a crisis. Okay, we'll watch this even more closely next week. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Walk the streets, screaming now.